Christmas time.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And my guest this week is the frontman with one of the greatest and biggest rock bands in the history of music. The singer on the second biggest-selling album of all time, which is also the biggest-selling rock album ever. Now, our guest today stepped into the limelight in 1980 at the age of 32, and that was after years of hard work as a gigging musician in the music scene of his native Newcastle and a moment of recognition with his band Geordie. He would then replace the late great Bon Scott after his death as the singer with AC/DC. His first job, recording Back in Black, which catapulted a big band into a global superpower with tens of millions of fans capable of filling stadiums all over the world. My guest this week on The First Time is lead singer with AC/DC. It's Brian Johnson. And you just heard You Shook Me All Night Long from Back in Black. And later in the episode, we'll hear about the surprisingly unglamorous way that genuinely iconic album was recorded. And we'll also find about Brian's journey to that moment, taking in singing competitions in scout huts and gigs in caravan sites along the way. And we'll also experience the constant throughout this incredible career. And the reason he's probably managed to navigate the scale of success that he has, it's his remarkable ability to keep his feet on the ground and stay down to earth. And this no-nonsense northeastern sense of humour, which remains completely intact and as strong as ever to this day. We'll also hear Brian talk very candidly about the difficulties he faced when he lost his hearing back in 2016, something that resulted in him parting company with AC/DC. But he also talks about the revelatory new technology that's brought his hearing back. And if you saw Brian singing AC/DC classics at the Taylor Hawkins tribute show earlier this year, you'll know he's back on full form. But I started by asking Brian, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
You know, it's a strange thing because there wasn't any, you know, Matt. You know, up in Newcastle or Dunstan where I lived, which was basically a mining village, but there was, you know, engineering as well and foundries. And it was dirty and, you know, and music, I think my dad had a Rediffusion receiver and it was like the light program. And I remember listening to songs like, and here's Dickie Valentine with his new hit. Well, how high is the moon? Oh, and here's another. Lift up your arms and surrender to me. Once there was a soldier. And you're just sitting there. Is that it? I'd rather go to church. You know, it wasn't very good. And then I remember the first time I heard Joe Brown, and I went, oh, yeah, that wonderful picture of you. I thought, this kid's brilliant.
In the night, there are sights to be seen. Stars like jewels on the crown of a queen. But the only sight I want to view is that.
It was very rare. I mean, you'd hear more chance of hearing a modern song on Uncle Mac's favourites on a Saturday morning. BBC television started at 12 and then it kind of went off at 12:30. And then it come back on again to Watch With Mother. I was watching it because following Watch With Mother, there was another riveting programme called Farming This Week. And at the time, they used to have interludes, Matt. They were about 3-4 minutes long. And there was a, you know, this da-da-da-da-da. And one day, this story I'm told a lot of times, but it's true. This one day, this woman with a beautiful plummy accent said, and now from America for the interlude, we have a wonderful young man with his new pop song. And it's called Tutti Frutti from Little Richard. And, you know, it came on and I saw this handsome young black man with a beautiful jacket on and this tie thing. And I'm sure he had eyeliner on, but I didn't care. His hair was immaculate and he just looked and went, oh, wham, bam, loom, bam, 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 bam. And it just, what is that? And I sat there with my jaw hanging to the floor, looking at this fabulous guy. And of course it finished and I wanted more, but that was then. And we didn't have a record player anywhere, you know. So, but it was 2 days later when I heard it coming out of a window, and I kind of believe what I did. I knocked on the door, and it was this girl came and said, who are you? I said, I'm Brian. I just live around the corner. I said, could you put that on again, please? And she said, well, you've got some nerve, but okay. She said, stand over there by the window, and I'll open it for you. And she put it on, and she came back out under the step, and she started doing the hand jive. She said, follow me. And I was doing that. And it was just brilliant. And I went over to her and I said, thank you. And she said, my name's Annette. And I said, thanks, Annette. And I'll never forget her. She was only about 18, but I thought she was an old lady. I was like 12 or 13 at the time.
To rock to the west, but she's the girl that I love. to me, Tutti Frutti.
When did you first perform on stage, and what did it give you?
Well, Matt, it was basically in the Boy Scouts. I was in the Sea Scouts in Dunstan, 15th Sea Scouts. And they had a gang show every year, which I didn't know anything about. And then so this guy came and auditioned everyone, you know, see who was a good dancer and see who could sing. I got up and sang something, and I forgot which. And he said, right, you... And then another you, and there was about five of us that were put down as solo singers. And I got on the stage, I'll never forget it, and they gave me a pair of jeans and a T-shirt, and I had to sing this quite rebellious song for the Scouts called Stay After School. And it went, stay after school, stay after school. And I would have been a bad boy and all that. And when I finished, there was this brilliant applause and that. I never had that because I just sang in the choir at church, and it felt so good. You know, I didn't know what it was, but I sure would have liked some more of it, you know. And I think anybody will tell you that, you know. The first gig we did was anything but that. The very first band I was in was called Section 5.
That's right, yeah.
And they were all boys, you know, apprentices from Parsons. We rehearsed in a prefab, Mr. and Mrs. Chance's prefab in the bedroom. They were super people. I mean, when you think there's four young kids knocking stuff out of this, you know, in this bedroom, and we were bad. Yeah, I mean, we were rotten. And it wasn't until I got new maracas that we got a little better. But now I had a little 10-watt amp. It was rotten. And a little crystal mic. And everybody was just knocking. We're trying to learn songs off the Rolling Stones' first album.
Yeah.
Oh, Carol, don't ever steal my heart away. And all of that Yama King bee buzzing around your head. All that good stuff. Until we had about 10 songs together. And it was Walker Boys Club, where apparently Eric Burden and all the Animals used to go. Mm. The guy, the priest or the vicar, just said, yeah, come up on Friday. And we'll get it in, and I can give you £2. And that was brilliant. We said, flipping it. And so we went up there. But we had to get there on the trolley bus because we didn't have a van. So I had
so to you're carrying all your gear.
I had a trolley. I put the drums under the stairs, you know. And the old conductor was just, you're not getting that on here. And I said, oh, how are you, mate? It's just two stops. So we got up there, and we got the gear up. You got to remember, we hardly knew how to put this stuff together. And the drummer, well, first drummer who had retired because he said it was impossible to hit the snare, the hi-hat, and the bass drum at the same time. So he was out. Anyway, we got this kid in who was ex-REF, so most of the band sounded, the song sounded like March. Well, anyway, we went on and, of course, were introduced as the first electrical band to play at Walker Boys Club, the first electrical band. Good God. We played our first song, and there was about 20 people in there. Nothing. That's when it hits you. That's when it hits you. You know, nothing. They were just leaning there, absolutely disinterested. And it's basically because, you know, we weren't very good at all.
Not too far back on the highway, not too long a ride.
ask you about Dylan, because I didn't have you pegged as a Dylan fan, but of course music is music, you know?
Yeah, well, Freewheeling was, you know, and still is, one of my great favourites. And, you know, I'm guilty of not calling it out enough in case people thought I wasn't rock and roll enough, thinking that people would say, well, what's he doing like in Dylan? And I'm ashamed of myself for that, I must admit, because, you know, Lennon said, he said it was the stuff, you know, stuff of greatness, you know, that album. The instant you hear it, you like every song on it. Doesn't happen many times, you know?
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, while the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine. If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds.
Let's talk about, because before this interview, obviously, I was doing a bit of research and I listened to Don't Do That by Geordie.
Yes.
It's a good tune, that. The middle eight's a little bit what the hell's going on, but it's a good tune. It's a good tune.
When I joined Geordie, and it was on the behest of the, you know, Vic Malcolm, who was a bit of a star up in Newcastle. Not like a big star, but he very well respected. And you know, he wrote his own songs, for God's sake. This was something. What we did were covers so we could get gigs at the social clubs. They didn't want to hear your songs, you know. And here was a guy that was, he was unafraid. He said, no, we're going to do our own songs. We'll play the clubs, but then we're going to go down to London, get a contract, get a record deal, and then we'll go out. And I'm going, yeah, hang on to that old chestnut. But, you know, he did. He got together and he got Tom Hill and Brian Gibson, who were two of the best of what they did up in Newcastle. You know, you could tell in the rehearsals something had changed. Mm. Everybody started concentrating a little bit more on what they were doing, because they realized, and there's nothing like it in the world, Matt, when you sing a song and you're the first one to sing it, or if you're a bass guitarist, you're the first bass guitarist to do it. It's still a thrill for me.
So was there that, because it's funny, you've always been really proud of where you come from, but also
absolutely,
even at that age, you're like, but there's a world out there as well. I want to see an experience. That you were, you were pretty ambitious at the same time, it seemed. Is that right?
Well, I was ambitious, but at the same time, I was very shy, you know. I mean, I realised very early, you know, like everybody wants to be a rock star, but I realised I didn't look like a rock star. I knew I would have to try harder. I knew there couldn't be just, well, I'll just stand there and everybody will just go crazy. I'm fabulous, I am. You know, no, I knew I would have to really be good at what I did. And I accepted that, you know, I was happy in my own skin. And I just knew I was happy with life, me friends, you know, because in this book, it's not just validating my life. It's validating the friends you gather around you who I still talk to. You know, George, the bus driver, he's retired now. But when I go to Newcastle, we go out for dinner and a pint. And Stevie Chance, the first bass player. Yes, we do. The boys and Geordie too. You know, it's important to me. You know, they've been friends all my life, no matter what happened to me.
Is that how you survived all this? Because you've done stuff that most musicians, most people could not imagine in terms of fame and exposure and pressure and attention. And you seem to have emerged through it all right. Do you reckon that's it? Friends?
Yeah, good friends that always, I'll tell you, you know, if
you're being a dick.
If you're being a dick, thanks. I never know what I can say anymore, you know. And it's always good. And you listen to them, you're like, really? Oh, man, I'm sorry. I didn't, you know. And I'm so proud of them. And me old dad, you know, he would stand anything like that, you know, trying to be cocky. He'd be on you. I remember he said, sir, you want to, because he caught us on the tape recorder, you know, me dad, I was singing. And he came and he said, fancy yourself as a singer, do you? I said, I do, dad. I'd like to be a professional singer. He said, there's only one singer in this world, Johnny Cash. And you're not Johnny Cash. and walked out the room and just shook his head and got nerd, you know. Early days, you know, we had all the fun with Geordie and all that. Of course, it was fun sitting in the back of, you know, the van and driving, because you were young, it didn't bother, you know, 5-6 hours at a time and getting to Bristol or somewhere, then having to drive back up to Carlisle to play a caravan site or some horrible place like that, you know. It's been a canny journey. And that's what I wanted to, in the book, I just wanted to say, because a lot of people thought in 1980, well, they've got this new singer called Brian Johnson. Where'd he come from? You know, a lot of people, I was 32. You know, for God's sake, this is an old guy come in them times, you know?
Because it's, a band is never not, it's not just this person is the best. That's why it will work. There's a chemistry. Yeah. There's personalities. Yeah. It's a really complex kind of machine. So I know vocally why you were the right man for the job, and you turn up and you do Nutbush City Limits and you do a whole lot of roses.
Yeah.
But what is it about you as a person that they felt like, yeah, this is the right person for us?
I think the thought that, first of all, I didn't have this attitude of like, hey, listen, I'm the singer. Okay.
that wasn't going to work.
And I just remember walking in, and when Malcolm walked over to me and said, yeah, mate, you drink this up in Newcastle. It was a bottle of brown ale. And I went, oh, mate, I could murder this. Because, you know, it was a 6-hour drive down there. And, you know, I said, that's just, you know, in them days, you just pop it. Oh, brilliant. Right, he says, what do you want to do? And I just looked around the room and I saw Cliff. And you've got to remember, these guys were still getting over Bond's passing. You know, it was still a terrible, terrible miss for them. And, you know, and I think they were doing this just for something to do, to keep going and, you know, to get this horrible thing out of their mind. And I think, you know, when I walked in, I'm a happy-go-lucky guy. You know, I had my cap on and I was just smiling and, hey, lads. But when they started Nutbush City Limits, I've got to tell you, I was in a different place. It was the best thing I think I'd ever heard in my life. You know, just how clean and crisp. And these guys didn't look like they were up for it. You know, they were just sitting. You know, Angus was just sitting and his mouth said, hang on, I think I know how it goes. And off he went and the boys joined in like a well-oiled machine and I'm just sitting there going, I sang me heart out. Not because I was trying to impress, I couldn't help it. There's a difference. I just couldn't help it.
A church house, gin house, a schoolhouse, outhouse, on highway number 19, the people keep the city clean, they call it Nutbush, oh Nutbush, on a Nutbush city limit, 25 was the speed limit, motorcycle not allowed in it, you're going to store fighters, you're going to church on Sundays, they call it Nutbush, little old town, oh Nutbush, they call it Nutbush city limit, you're going to feel on weekdays, and have a picnic on Labor Day, you're going to town on Saturdays, but going to church every Sunday, they call it Nutbush, oh Nutbush, they call it Nutbush city limit.
It was the best I'd ever sung it, and I was just all woo. And when it finished, nothing was said. There was just his looks, you know. And I said, "Do you know any of our songs?" And I said, "Rosie, let's do it." And off we went. And you know, and it was fabulous. But the strange thing was, at the end, I said, "Well, lads, thanks very much." I said, "Wait till I tell the boys in the band up in Newcastle that I had to sing." I had to sing with you. I said, but I got to pop. It was about 8 o'clock. I said, I've got to pop off now, lads. I said, I've got a long drive back to Newcastle. And we're going, what do you mean? I went, I've got to get back to town. I've got to open up the factory in the morning. Had a little business up there, you know. They said, well, when you come back? I said, this was the manager, Peter Mensch. I said, well, give us a ring. I said, but I've got a gig tomorrow night, you know. So it was like that. It was lovely and it wasn't. It wasn't planned like that. It was a lovely, happy accident of everything being just right. And I don't think it could ever happen again.
Won't tell you a story about a woman I know. I come loving, steal the show. She ain't exactly pretty, ain't exactly small. 4239 56. You can say she got it all.
That was Whole Lotta Rosie by AC/DC featuring Bon Scott on vocals, the man our guest this week had to replace in 1980 after his tragic death. And we'll be back to find out more about that fateful first session with AC/DC all after the 6 music news.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. This is Anthony Birchley. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, has urged unions to back reforms to the rail industry to free up the savings to fund pay rises. He rejected suggestions the government was blocking efforts to reach a deal to prevent further rail strikes, but insisted inflation-matching pay increases were not affordable. The General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, Francis O'Grady, thinks the government could find the money.
This is about political choices. We've seen the cap lifted on bankers' bonuses, but nurses' pay driven down. We could give every public servant in this country an inflation-proof pay rise if we equalised capital gains tax on selling shares and second homes with income tax. That would raise enough money.
The Metropolitan Police have said the murders of two teenagers in southeast London yesterday evening are linked. The two 16-year-olds were stabbed and killed a mile from each other in Thamesmead and Abbey Wood. Protests against the Chinese government's strict COVID measures have intensified, with some people publicly venting their anger at the Communist Party leaders. Thousands of protesters have turned out in cities across the country. Charities have urged ministers to go further to protect children from harmful online content after the government announced plans to criminalise the encouragement of self-harm. Ministers said the change to the online safety bill had been influenced by the case of Molly Russell, the 14-year-old who killed herself in 2017. Angus Crawford reports.
The government wants to introduce a new clause into the much-delayed bill, which will make it a criminal offence to encourage other users to hurt themselves. The measure was first proposed by a parliamentary committee a year ago and will be presented as an amendment when the whole bill is reintroduced next month. A new offence then in a delayed bill with more parliamentary hurdles to clear. There are differences of opinion within the Conservative Party about the legislation in general, particularly around protections for freedom of speech.
Concerns have been expressed that many people in the UK are being let down at the end of their lives by inadequate out-of-hours support. The Marie Curie charity says that's leading to a significant number of avoidable visits to emergency departments by people who'd be better cared for in the community. Costa Rica have beaten Japan 1-0 to keep their chances of reaching the knockout stages of the World Cup alive. Dan Orlovitz writes about sport for the Japan Times and says Japanese fans are very disappointed.
They came into this game wanting and expecting so much more, especially because of that result against Germany. But as it turned out, in some ways, the clock has struck midnight and Japan has turned back into a pumpkin, because this was a game that fell well below everyone's expectations for how well this team could perform.
Belgium are currently playing Morocco and the score is 0-0. That's the latest Six Music News. Your next update is at 2:30.
BBC Radio
Six Music.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on 6 Music. And my guest this week is AC/DC frontman Brian Johnson. And you just heard Thunderstruck, released in 1990. If you haven't seen the footage of AC/DC performing that song live at River Plate in 2009, seek it out. It's the greatest thing ever. Before the break, we were talking about Brian's audition for AC/DC back in 1980, a session that went so well, he was in the studio recording with the band within weeks. And the album they made was Back in Black, a record that would go on to sell over 50 million copies worldwide. Let's head back into our conversation as I asked Brian how it felt to be part of that record.
It's quite embarrassing when people say, because it, to me, I'm part of it.
This is, and, it. You know, it's like, and, what I was going to ask.
And it was, once again, that happy accidental thing, you know. But when when Peter Mensch said, I'm sorry, lads, I can't go to Sweden because ABBA's going to use the studio for the next few weeks. I went, oh, he said, don't worry, though. We're going to the Bahamas.
Yes, get in.
Right, okay, then. I said, when we're leaving? He said, 2 days.
What?
I said, I better tell the boys in the band I'm making an album. I still thought the boys weren't sure. Yeah, I don't know. I was just, it was too big a step, you know.
Yeah, it's a huge thing to go to there, to go from where you're from to recording that record.
I was waiting for somebody to walk in at the last minute and go, oh, it's all right. The guy from Australia said he would take it. Anyway, we got on the plane and, of course, we were all sitting in the back. You know, with the band weren't wealthy. You know, people keep thinking it was this like billionaire band. Was it? you know, they had to look after their pennies. You know, like anybody else, and sat in the back smoking taps, drinking beer mainly. You know, and just got drunk, and then we landed at the Bahamas. And of course, there wasn't a walkway then. You had to climb down the steps. So I'm standing in like 90 odd degrees, in my jeans. And me, the only pair of shoes I owned, which were the, me Brooks boots, two pairs of underpants in me bag, two spare T-shirts, and a denim bomber jacket in me cloth cap on. That was it. You know, I had a toothbrush, shaving gear. I didn't even have a pair of shorts. Well, who would in Newcastle? Not recommended. It was from there. I've asked Cliff and a couple of lads a few times. I said, what was the exact where we did it? You know, I think you guys went in first, and then Mutt would say, right, Brian, I want you 2 hours, come in and sing, and I want you gone. I don't want any voices being bust. That's the way I work. And he was very, very strict. And then the band come back in. And I asked the lads, I said, how did all of them say, Brian, it was a blur. I think Angus is the only one that could remember. Angus has got a memory, man. He can remember everything. But for me, it was a blur. And as soon as what time was up, Phil went first just to save money on the rooms. I should I say cells. These were cinder block cells with a single bed in it and a toilet and a wash basin. That was it. No air conditioning.
Really?
Yeah. I had a spear gun given us by the housekeeper in case the Tahitian drug dealers came down to try to rob her. And I went, what? So I'm sitting with this thing. And then she came 2 days later and gave us a machete just in case for close quarter fighting. And it was pretty dangerous. So they wouldn't let her out at night on her own. You know, and it was only about 200 yards to the studio, but it wasn't well lit. You know, the power goes out every 2 days or something, you know.
Good God.
And little things like that.
Yeah.
boy, it just happened so quick. 6 weeks. The production team stayed behind, you know, and mixed it.
Yeah.
And I know Malcolm and Angus stayed with them because they're very big into that. And I was back in Newcastle. I'll never forget. And I was at my mum and dad's, and they didn't have a record player. So I waited a month to get a copy. I mean, you got to remember, I was going, did that really happen? And I came in with a post, and I opened and I said, it's Black. I said, this is, it must have been tight for money for the cover. So I phoned up our guitarist and Geordie too. I said, can I come down and play the new record on your stereo? And he said, come on down. So I brought it down and put it on, and the first one was Hell's Bells, which has like 30 second intro. And I went, and I started singing. After two lines, he lifted the needle up and he went, too high for you. That, come on, let's get a pint. He said, you're not at 5 minutes. That's funny. And I was pretty down, and I went, oh, Jesus. I said, how are they? And that was my first listening to Back in Black. Deep Ruth, and God bless him.
About keeping your feet on the ground, keeping connected to Newcastle, but when it got big, and it got big, no one, that's like getting on a roller coaster and you don't know what the end is. I mean, do you think you cope with it quite well?
Yeah, well, strange things started to happen to me. People in Mercedes were going, hi, Brian. Who's he? You know, and it's hard not to get wrapped up in it all, with people following you. They didn't yet know who you were, really. And then all of a sudden, they're just so fascinatingly interested in you, and they just love to have a drink. And it was all quite strange, you know, and hard to get over. You're just not equipped. Yeah. For it. Nobody warned you that this was going to happen. And thankfully, you know, and then the band started, said, right, we're going on tour. We're going to rehearse for 3 weeks. Because you, Brian, have to learn all the old songs as well as the new ones.
Here's a good question. What did you do with your first royalty check? Well, that first one, it's like, right, is it get the mama bungalow? That first biggie.
I was completely and utterly selfish. I'd never had a new car in my life, ever. You know, and here I was, 32, and I never had a new car in my life. We were always 6, 7, 8-year-old bangers. And a friend of mine, Mickey Benison, he was a car dealer, and the nickname of his company was Third Leg Motors. It was called that because he sold American cars. The American cars were horrible back then, but there was an SUV called a Chevy Blazer. And it was something like, it was, up against the Range Rover, which was like real expensive. This was something like £5,500. And it was brilliant. You know, it was up high, it was automatic, two-door. And the important thing was it was black with a big, thick, white stripe, exact colours, and a white roof, same colours as Newcastle United. Just had to have it. I enjoyed that car so much.
In March 2016, as you talk about in the book, yeah. Tell me about that feeling when they first went, when it stopped working, because this is
well, it was,
what's life without sound for you? What's life without music for you? Did all that go through your mind?
It's worse than that. You get into your motor car and you can't tell who's singing the song. You can't tell the song. It's just this noise.
Right.
It's horrible.
What kind of noise? Like white noise or what is it?
No, just a music-y noise, but you don't know what key it's in. You
right.
can't hear who's singing it. You can't tell if it's Paul McCartney or Mick Jagger. It's a horrible grey area. I think I called it a murderous silence.
Yeah.
And it certainly is. It's just, I kind of describe it all, but... You know, I did it the way I always do it. I just got the best whiskey I could have and sat in my office and just, you know, tried to forget all about it and didn't answer the phone, wouldn't talk to any kind of press, you know, because they were like vultures coming in. I just kept myself to myself. It was the best thing for us, you know. And it came, you know, the ears started to come, you know. Stephen Ambrose, who did them, he put them in, were trying them, developing them. And I could see there was light at the end of the tunnel, but, you know, it was a long way off. And then the great thing was Angus phoned up and he just said, hey, them ears working. I said, brilliant. He said, you want to do an album? I went, I'll be there yesterday.
I don't really understand the technology, so obviously,
it's easy.
How does it work that you managed to get your hearing back? How does it work?
It's easy. It's a tiny, small, little sack. You put it in your ear. You don't have to get fitted. You put it in your ear, and there's a little thing on the end, a little tube, and it's the pump. And you press it, and it inflates,
right.
And it becomes an eardrum. And it uses the bones here, and the bones in the chin, and the bones, you know. But also, it can be fitted to Bluetooth, and you can hear it. And you can hear 360, globally, as they call it. And there's no hissing, like, You know, these regular hearings are always hissing and sissing. And it's just, I think it's going to help so much. It's already helped Katie Lang. She was going to retire. We sent it out to her and she started crying on the Zoom. And she's back out on the road now. We're going to knock on Huey Lewis needs it. A lot of people now, because it's something new, it can be scary. So, but it isn't. It's nothing. It's just absolutely wonderful.
You're like the Red Cross for, like, rock singers. This is amazing.
Well, hopefully we want to get it out to the public to make it cheap enough so we can help people who are really deaf, you know, and war zones and soldiers and guys who worked on aircraft, you know, and tank drivers. You know, I got to tell you the other day, you know, a couple of months ago, Dave Grohl said, hey, listen, you know, because Taylor, I love Taylor.
Yeah.
Hawkins, you know, and he said, would you come and sing at Wembley with me? Do a couple of songs. I said, because me and the band had tried these things out in a rehearsal, but we'd never tried them, you know, in a field of battle.
Yeah.
I said, I've got to do it sometime. So I went there, we rehearsed a couple of days with him, which once again, that's just a rehearsal. And there I was on the side of the stage, like 100,000 people, and it's getting streamed to about 300 million. And a guy comes up and he goes, here you go, Brian, there's the mic. And I just said, this is it. You know, I'm 74 years old. And the first song was Back in Black. That's not for trainees. That's, you know, that's full apprenticeship, that one.
Yeah.
And I went with these New Years and he said, I can't tell you. It worked like I was 25 years old.
How did that feel? How did that feel?
Oh, it's absolutely, it's incredible. It's incredible.
What did you learn about yourself doing this book?
I'm tougher than I thought. I didn't realise you had to be that tough to do things. Other guys are gifted in all different kinds of ways. I have to work at everything I do, and I work hard at it.
Is it still in you? I mean, I saw you at Wembley at the Taylor show, which was amazing. It was an emotional show. You could really feel the love for him there. But, like, the singing story doesn't stop here, does it, for you?
Well, I thought I did all right, you know. I got up there. I was worried when I went on. I said, nobody's going to know who I am.
Come on, Brian.
I'm telling you, I got all these young kids in here. So you can imagine how great it felt. I remember coming off when we finished and I walked up to Pabs, our sound guy, and I went, I'll miss this. What a great night that was. I would hope that there's something left somehow, somewhere, you know, just to have a great time.
That's a very tactful way of answering the question. The door is open, my friend.
Yeah, we'll see.
And the last question is, you get to pick the last song we'll play. What should we go out on?
You know, Dan McCafferty, my good friend, went yesterday. I love Dan. And it was through Dan, I said, I want to sing like him. And that was at a submarine base in Glasgow. When they were supporting Geordie, Nazareth were there. And I stopped and watched them first. And I just went, what a band. And that's when I got the first feeling that Geordie were just getting left behind a little with his pop stuff. Mm-hmm. It was that night he took me out to our van and he said, have you got a cassette? And I said, yes. He said, this is our new single, you know. He said, do you want to hear it? And I said, yeah, come on, let's go out. I said, anyway, because it was a big fight in the dance hall with the Navy boys. And we went out of the van and he put it on. And I listened to it and I went, oh my, and it was Broken Down Angel. So can I play this in a memory of Dan McCafferty, me good pal, and to all his family?
Then that's the last song we'll finish on. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate.
Thanks. Seeing you that side, kidder. Toodle pips.
That was Broken Down Angel by Nazareth, whose lead singer, Dan McCafferty, passed away the day before we recorded the interview with Brian, a fitting tribute. And that is the end of this week's show. Don't forget, you can go back and listen to a load of first-time shows from the archive on BBC Sounds, including recent episodes with Danger Mouse, my conversations with Martha Wainwright, Stuart Murdoch, Paul Weller, Janelle Monáe, and also the show we did with Wilco Johnson, who sadly passed away this week. But we'll be back with another new episode of The First Time next week with singer, songwriter and producer Santi Gold. I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.